And again, it's a first glimpse, but it makes us start to think that if there is genetic predisposition to different types of traits, that diet may be one way that we might be able to overcome, at least to some degree, what is encoded in the genome. So this is a pretty exciting find for us. Now, remember I said from those same animals, we also collected a segment of the ileum. And the reason we did that is because we wanted to ask the question, does host genetics influence the adaptive immune response? Of course, we expect that to be the case. And do we see any association of that with the microbiome? And so what we did was we characterized, we actually quantified the adaptive immune response, or at least a portion of the adaptive immune response in these same animals. And we did it, again, we did it by DNA sequencing. And what we did was we sequenced the rearranged immunoglobulin receptors from the secretory IgA. So immunoglobulin A is the predominant type of immunoglobulin that's secreted, that's translocated across the epithelium in the gut. And it's secreted largely by B cells, and there's large populations of them that are in the ileum. That's why we collected the ileal segment. The genes that encode the immunoglobulins, these are rearranged during B cell development, during development of these antibody-secreting cells. So as the B cells develop, the genes are rearranged, they produce a particular type of antibody, and if that particular type of B cell gets tagged or gets stimulated at some point in the animal's life, you'll see it expand and it will start producing lots and lots of this immunoglobulin A. So the immunoglobulin A population that we're looking at in these particular animals is likely the population that's being expressed right at the very time that we collected the ileum from them. And so what we're able to do is to use DNA sequencing and to make a long story short, look at the rearranged immunoglobulin genes. There's about 250 of these different immunoglobulin genes that sit at this locus called IgH. And as I said, those genes rearrange in various combinations. And so we can use DNA sequencing to look at the rearrangement, and we can actually quantify utilization of those individual germline genes in a rearrangement. So that's the process that we went through. And of course, the first thing we did was to take each of those quantifications of those rearranged immunoglobulins and ask the question, do we see host genetic control over that? We expect to see that, and certainly we did, for a good two-thirds of those different immunoglobulin segments. We saw very, very high LOD scores on the QTL mapping, and the mapping right back to chromosome 12, which is the locus where the IgH actually resides. The others that aren't shown on this graph, I think they may come up later, actually map to the major histocompatibility complex, which also participates in the process of stimulating these immunoglobulin receptors and being produced. So that tells us that at least our phenotyping method is in check. We're phenotyping things accurately. We have QTLs that are mapping to locations where we expect them to find. So at least the way we're processing the data here is probably okay. Then I get to do the actual experiment that I really want to do, and that is, do I now see correlation between the immunoglobulins that are being expressed in these animals and the composition of the microbiome? And so what you're looking at here is a big correlation matrix that's been done, the simple correlation between the immunoglobulin variable regions, which are on the, if you're looking at the top part, they're on the left, and the microbiome taxa that are all shown on the right. So each individual column there on the left-hand side is the immunoglobulin variable region gene, and the top of the rows are as well, and the same for the microbiota on the right. And you can see from the colors on the heat map down there, we see a fair amount of correlation between which of the IgH variable region genes are being used in any given animal. And we also see a fair amount of positive correlation within the microbiome itself. So we have certain taxa that tend to co-occur with one another in the microbiome. The very disappointing part of this whole exercise is that big blank spot on the left part of that of this heat map, where we see absolutely no correlation between immunoglobulins that are being secreted in these animals and the composition of the microbiome. that was a little bit unanticipated, and there might be some explanations for this. And I think one of the explanations might be that the antibody response is so specific that we can't see it at the level of the whole microbiome. In other words, the immunoglobulin response is only affecting certain individual taxa, and we can't see that at the whole level of looking at the microbiome. The other explanation is that there essentially is no correlation, right? That there's essentially some degree of randomness in the IgAs that are being synthesized or secreted in this environment, and it has very little impact on the microbiome. And I'll tell you a little aside story. One of my colleagues, Jens Walter, who studies lactic acid bacteria, one of the organisms that he studies in particular is called Lactobacillus reuteri. And if you take Lactobacillus reuteri and you put it into a germ-free animal, this is an animal that has absolutely no bacteria in it. So this is, we call this a mono-association. You put this individual bacterial species into that animal and you look at which immunoglobulins it's secreting, what you find is that it's very strain-specific. Each strain of Lactobacillus reuteri that you put into those animals will generate a different variety of antibodies that are being produced. So there's a lot of strain specificity that's being elicited in the antibody responses under those conditions. The second thing that you find is that this organism, Lactobacillus reuteri, actually makes a biofilm. It literally grows as a biofilm in these animals. And even in a conventional animal, you'll find this organism as a biofilm in the forehead of the mouse. But within that biofilm, the organism actually incorporates IgA as part of the biofilm. So it's almost as if the bacteria want to stimulate the host to make IgA so the bacteria can use it as part of its biofilm. So this may be a much more complex scenario than we ever thought going into it. And this lack of correlation here may actually be telling us something about how the system actually functions. Okay, so moving along here, I hope you can begin to appreciate now the type of, this is really a systems biology view that we're able to get here from looking at these experiments that we've done early on. So you can see that we're being able to start to observe the impact of host genetics on composition of the microbiome. We can start to look at the interaction of diet with host genetics, and we can start to look at things like specific types of antibody responses. We can play the same game with T-cell responses. We want to look at that. But we can begin to put this whole picture together to start to ask the question of how this microbiome really gets assembled. And so that's where we're heading, and I'm not going to bore you too much, but we're moving down this path now. This is the future directions for us. Moving down this path, looking into some very complex populations of mice that are being generated. These are genetic resource populations of mice that are being generated, and it's a very nice population. They all emanate from the same eight parental, inbred parental lines. So all those lines have been sequenced. We can always relate everything back to those eight lines. There's a discovery population that's on the left, that's an outbred population. And then there's a validation population for hypothesis testing. That's an inbred population, a series of recombinant inbreds on the right. So the idea is you can do trait discovery in one population, you can do validation in the second. The powerful thing about these animals for us is that when we discover loci of relevance to us that we're interested in, and we validate them in the inbreds, those inbreds can then be brought in, and we can re-derive those inbreds germ-free. And once they're germ-free, if we have polarizing inbred lines, we can begin to study microbiome assembly by essentially adding organisms back into there and asking, can we predict now the order in which these things assemble in these human animals? We've also had to, and this is a point of contention for me, because the sequencing platforms are a very rapidly moving train. Even since 2005, we're already on our next generation and getting ready for yet the third generation of these sequencing platforms that are coming out. And they're all fighting tooth and nail to get to the top of the heap because they're all chasing the $1,000 human genome. And because of that, if you're using it as a phenotyping platform as opposed to a genotyping platform, you have to keep moving with the train. So we've moved on with the train now, and rather than sequencing just an individual gene from the microbiome, we have the capacity, we have so much greater sequencing capacity now, we just shear everything up and sequence the heck out of it. We call this full metagenome sequencing, and then again, we allow the computers to try and reassemble the mess back into something that resembles what we think was a microbiome. And I tried to use the same diagram to imprint on your mind. If you remember the first time we went through that, how many different sequences did I say we were grabbing? How many marbles were we grabbing out of the jar? If I remember, 10,000. Look at where we are now, 5 to 20 million per sampling set. And we could go deeper than that if we had the. We're only limited by budget at this point, because the capacity is there. So the depth is so much greater at which we can start sampling that doing this full metagenome sequencing is definitely the way to go. And the advantage of doing full metagenome is that we get not only the taxonomic content of the microbiome, but we also can get the functional content out of that as well. And I'll show you our first set of data that's coming out of these this diversity outcross of animals that I'm pretty excited about. So on the left now, so this is out of 300 different animals from that diversity outcross. Again, these are mice. On the left is the typical box and whiskers plot. Now you're used to seeing that's the distribution of the core, about 70 different genera, microbial genera, that we detected across most of those animals. Shown on the upper right now, I've separated or I've sorted those animals on the basis of the relative abundance of different groups of microorganisms, and those are shown in the boxes there in the upper right, in the green box and in the blue box. And those organisms do a couple of different things. The ones on the right essentially make lots of acetate and other short-chain fatty acids. The organisms on the left, well, they make short-chain fatty acids, but they also have the capacity to make methane, and they have the capacity to produce hydrogen sulfide. And so these microbial populations in these animals look like they're to some degree polarized. Like we have animals on the far left that are going to be having some methane production, probably some H2S production, and animals on the far right that probably don't do that very much. Those microorganisms are either absent or not very abundant in those animals. And so the physiology, the gut physiology of those animals, I would expect to be quite different. That's the point I'm trying to get across. And if you now take that same data set and you sort it on the basis of a function, right, so now I'm not looking at the taxa, I've thrown out the taxa, and I'm just looking at the genes that are present, and I ask, can I now separate those animals on the basis of their gene functions? Sure enough, you start to see the groupings on the bottom right there. You start to see the two groupings showing up in the principal component analysis of the functions. So we can see this sort of taxonomic segregation and how that translates into a functional segregation or a functional difference in what the microbiome is actually doing in these animals. So we're pretty excited about having this technology on hand now and being able to move forward with it. So this is, I've shown you a couple of the mouse experiments, but I want to talk about the one on the left here. I call these the data generators in my group, but the one on the left here is the one that's important. So now we're going to go back and we're going to talk about bovine again. So in our schizophrenia, we're going to talk about the bovine model now. So this is a beautiful collaboration that I've been engaged in with the guys out at Clay Center at the Meat Animal Research Center. And this is to ask the question of whether there is genetic control over the shigatoxin producing E. coli. There's lots of different factors that have been studied in terms of food safety and looking at shedding of E. coli 0157H7 and these other shigatoxin producing E. coli. But the one factor that has not been studied is breeding and genetics, whether breeding and genetics can actually have an impact on distribution of these organisms. So there's 1,500 animals in this particular experiment, at least four different diets, and hopefully three different geographic regions that will be included. And if you look at the bottom of that little green box there, you notice there's about 60 billion paired in reads. So again, just notice that number just keeps going up. That's how many sequences we'll actually generate just from characterizing the microbiome across all these animals. So this is, again, this is a translation of what we're finding in the mouse word into the ag biotech. And there's obviously areas for translation into biomedicine, but I think there's plenty of opportunities for translating what we're doing in these mouse populations into the ag biotech. So I'll give you just a little bit of data from this one example where we're looking at or trying to look for association with Shigatoxin producing E. coli. I should mention that this isn't just relevant to Shigatoxin producing E. coli. Because we're doing this by sequencing, we can actually see all of these different organisms. So we can actually look for Salmonella, we can actually look for Campylobacter, we can measure association for all these organisms in exactly the same data set. So keep that in mind as we go through. So the question is whether shedding of these organisms could be considered a quantitative trait and something that might reflect a complex quantitative trait. And I just show you here, this is a distribution of shedding and the number of animals shown on the left and the log abundance of the organisms, log abundance of 0157 E. coli that's being shed in those animals shown on the x-axis. And again, you see log normal distribution, just like I showed you in all those other box and whiskers plots, the log normal distribution of the gut microbial taxa. We could treat this thing as just the same as we have any of those other taxa that we've studied in the mouse populations. That's the study design. So we started sequencing, and this is where I have to be careful and not get too frustrated at what I say, but we started sequencing on this on an earlier platform, and we got about 300 animals, 400 animals into it, and they changed reagents on the platform, and that platform was no longer available to us. I'll just say it and leave it at that. I was not happy at that point in time, but we have taken that data and tried to milk from it what we could learn along the way. And so this is some of the bioinformatics that was done by Min-Seok Kim out of the Meat Animal Research Center. And what he did was, within those roughly 300 animals that we looked at, he asked the question, there was at least two different diets that were reflected in there, and he asked the question, do we see impact of diet on the microbes that we see in these? Now, these are colonic populations, and sure enough, the answer is yes. If you look at the principal component analysis there on the right, you see that those animals and the microbiome separate quite nicely by diet. So clearly diet's going to be a factor that was intentionally incorporated into this experimental design, and it's definitely something that will be a factor that will be included in the genetic analysis as well. We're sampling these animals seven different time points, and during each of these time points, we're quantifying the enterohemorrhagic E. coli and then the Shigatoxin-producing E. coli in each individual sample. For sequencing, because that would have drove the cost up even more, for sequencing, we're essentially compositing them. And so one of the first questions we asked with this early data set was, is there going to be any effect of compositing? And so here I've got samples from a couple different dates in July, and I think one in August, or a couple dates in August and one in July, that are on this particular linear discriminant analysis. And what you see is that they're essentially overlapping. So if I look at the individual samples, I look at the microbiome in the individual samples, I don't see a lot of segregation by date on the distribution of the microbiome. So it appears that it'll be okay to composite those samples and just sequence one from each animal rather than having to sequence all seven. And then, and again, here's just another analysis that we did to show that that both year and diet are confounding factors in these populations. You see these animals definitely segregate by diet and by year. But this is the one thing I wanted to show you, and I kind of wanted to leave you with this, because this is an analysis where now I grouped the animals on the basis of the amount of Shigatoxin producing, or in this case it's 0157H7 E. coli that they're shedding. And I categorized them in essentially three simple categories, and that is those animals that we would call super shedders, that they're shedding more than 10,000 CFUs per gram of feces. They're shown in the yellow dots. The shedders, those are animals that are shedding detectable levels during the sampling period. And then the ones on the in red on the right, those are the non-shedders. And those animals were unique in that we could detect 0157 in them at any point in time during the sampling period. And what was surprising about that is we start to see some separation between these non-shedders and the bulk of the shedding animals that are in the blue and in the yellow there. And that might be exciting because if there's something about that microbiome that's unique, and that's what this graph would tell us, there's something unique about the microbiome in these non-shedding animals. Understanding what it is that's unique about them could clearly be something we could incorporate downstream into treatments, interventions. On top of that, if that's under genetic control, as we're hoping and as we suspect, then we can map those loci then. We'll have different tests that could be developed at some point in time that would allow you to incorporate what's called food safety traits into breeding programs. And so you could think of this in the same way you would feed efficiency or anything else. These food safety traits could also be incorporated into the breeding programs. The other exciting thing about this study is that because we're using the sequence-based approach and because we have the capacity to see the whole microbiome now, especially with the metagenome sequencing, is that if we see, let's say there is genetic effect, and we see genetic effect and then that it reduces the level of 0157 E. coli, what we can also see is what fills in that niche, because that's one of the scary questions when you get into manipulating these ecosystems, is that once you remove something or purge something from the ecosystem, usually something else fills in its niche. And we have examples of that being done, especially in animal production, where we cull particular animals for their shedding or carriage of a particular pathogen, and the next thing we know is another pathogen shows up and fills in the niche. So the nice thing about the study design and the phenotyping methods is we have the ability to capture all of that data into the same study. All right, so that's the last data slide, and now I'll try to throw some conclusions at you through this sort of cow and mouse combination here. So what have we really learned along the way? Certainly these deterministic factors, so that word deterministic, that means niche-specific factors or host-specific factors, such as host genetics, these are very measurable, and they clearly have an impact on the microbiome. I didn't have time to show you this, but some of the microbiome QTLs that we found actually overlap disease predisposition QTLs, and so that actually tells us it starts to pose new models to us for disease predisposition. Thirdly, that diet can, this is what I'm excited about, that diet can potentially modify allelic effects of QTLs on composition. And what that really means to us in terms of human disease is that if there is disease predisposition that's related to certain loci, we might be able to use diet to modify, especially if it's a disease predisposition that works through the microbiome, we may be able to use diet to modify that effect. Secreted IgA doesn't appear to play a major role in shaping microbiome composition, so if we hope to do it through the immune system, we may have to be thinking differently about how the immune system functions. And hopefully I've shown you that this metagenomic phenotyping will really pave the way for really understanding how this host shapes not only the taxonomic content, but also the functional content of the microbiome. And I just want to end lastly with this slide here because there are several people in this room that have contributed a lot to the data that I've talked about. Steve Kochman has contributed a ton to this, and he's one I can't live without, so I give him credit every time I can. I know also there's folks from the USDA Meat Animal Research Center here. And again, they've done all the hard work out in the field of sampling the animals, managing the animals, all of the hard microbiology. We just get to do the fun sequencing and play with the sequence data. I mean, they even put the fecal samples in 96-well plates and send it to us. So, I mean, I can't praise them enough for the stuff that they do. And then, of course, Daniel Pomp and several of the people at University of North Carolina and System that I've worked with, and a lot of the postdocs and grad students along the way. I'll stop there because I know you're meeting close to lunch.